In this segment, Stephen will examine the power of paradigm shifting and how you can use it to be more effective in your life.
This whole idea of paradigms. Any of you ever heard the word? In a sense, it's the way you see the world. It's your worldview. And it comes out of your frame of reference, see? Comes out of your frame of reference. And everyone has a different frame of reference. In fact, just yesterday, someone was telling me the story of how some people from a small Indian village were being shown the picture of the Empire State Building as evidence of the, you know, the great advancement we've made in our civilization. The first question was, how many sheep does it hold? The frame of reference comes out of a person's experience, and they look at something out there and they're asking the question out of that frame of reference. Now, I'm going to suggest, I do suggest now, that the key to major improvements in our lives, major, significant, large ones, major advances, comes from shifting our frame of reference, shifting our paradigm. I'll explain a little more what I mean, because I know it's a little abstract and unclear right now. I'll give you some illustrations. I just wanted to kind of get to the bottom line fast. If you really want to make significant improvements, huge quantum increases, change your frame of reference or your paradigm. If you want to make minor improvements, small improvements, then change your behavior or your attitude. Behavior and attitude are both effects of the deeper frame of reference, the cause. Now, all of us know ways that you and I should behave a little differently and how we can improve our attitudes a little. But those are still effects. Let me give you a story. Here's the paradigm shift. I was on a subway in New York. One man came in with a bunch of little kids, and they were wild. I thought for sure that they would settle down after 2 or 3 minutes on the subway. But they were running up and down and climbing around and really, really upsetting and disturbing people. I was just observing this whole scene, and this continued on so much it became irritating to people. And I started to feel some irritation. And the father just kind of sat there, kind of looking around. His head was down a lot of the time. I was kind of annoyed, and I went up to him and I said, "Sir, you know, your children are so upsetting to so many people. Don't you think you can control them a little better than this?" And he said, "Oh, I know. Yeah, we've just come from the hospital and they've just lost their mother and they don't know quite how to handle it, I guess, and I don't either. I mean, so hard, see." Now, imagine you're in that situation. Would you have a paradigm shift? In fact, didn't you just have it just now? You see him totally differently, don't you? Now, what if I'd really tried to just change my behavior a little? Not speak with, say, irritation in my voice, or have a little better attitude toward him, see? Or just smile about it. But no effort to see it from another frame of reference, see? You can see how I can make a little improvement in the situation. But when a fundamental shift took place in the way I saw that situation, then I immediately wanted to help him. Let me help with the children. Let me entertain them or play with them. I'm so sorry about the loss of their mother and your wife. It's just so... Can you tell me a little about it, see? In other words, it spontaneously, it sincerely came out of me. New behavior, new attitudes. You don't consciously work on behavior and attitudes. What you do is work on your paradigm. Then the behavior and the attitude will automatically begin to change. Now, paradigm is a word that comes from the Greek word paradigma. It means pattern, how you see reality. Let me use a metaphor, a map. You have a map, let's say, of the city. It's Say it's the city of Chicago, okay? Your first name again?
Joe.
Joe. You invite me to your business. And you send to me instructions how to get there, and I go to the O'Hare Airport, and I rent a car, and I follow your instructions. But you happen to send to me a map of Detroit. And the printer made an error. At the top it says, street map of Chicago. Okay? What's going to happen?
You're going to be misled and confused, bro.
Yeah, right from the very outset. I mean, I just can't find one thing that's on that map. Is that discouraging to a person? Mm-hmm. You know, so I call you up and say, Joe, you know, I am really confused by this. So you say to me, Stephen, try harder. You know, you're in the school of thought that diligence is the key to life. Work harder at it. Change your behavior, Stephen. I can sense that you're kind of giving up. Change your behavior. So I change my behavior and I really speed up. Boy, I am doubling my speed on those highways and so forth. Now what happens? I'm lost twice as fast, right? Now what happens to your attitude and spirit? Try. It's worse than ever. This time when I called Joe up, he can sense my attitude is very low. So another very common approach is change your attitude, Stephen. So he tells me, Stephen, think positively. And he asks where I am, and I tell him I'm at a drugstore, and there's a bookstore right next to it he's aware of. He says, go in there and pick up the PMA literature, Positive Mental Attitude. So I go in there, and I just pick up a bunch of titles, and I read the material, and I get so psyched you can't believe it. Now I just get into that car, and I rip off again. Now what happens? See, I changed my attitude that time. I didn't change my map. I didn't change my paradigm. I changed my attitude. Behavior change didn't work. Changed my attitude. The panacea. You've heard the expressions all your life long. Your altitude is a function of your attitude. I mean, the buzzwords are everywhere. Now, nothing's wrong with a good positive attitude. I'm very much in favor of it. As long as you have the right map. Otherwise, I will follow your counsel. Only this time, I don't care if I'm lost. I'm contented where I am, see? Because I have this positive attitude and I'm exuding positive energy. Never show up at your place, but so what? I adapt to the reality of life. Can you see the idea? You have to change your map. You have to get a map that corresponds to the reality. Now, sometimes paradigms are dead wrong. Dead wrong. Let me use this metaphor for a second, the map metaphor, and show you what I mean. Where do you think most people get their self-maps? From other people. Most people do. Let's call that the social mirror. The social mirror. So that every time I walk, I look at this mirror, and it reflects back what I am. And if you and you and you all agree, that's called validation. Now, inside myself, I come to believe what you tell me. That I'm not a good student, I'm not a good memorizer, I'm not creative, or the opposite. I am a good student, I memorize well, I am creative. So it comes from the social mirror. Are you with me? Now, are those maps the territory? Is the map the territory? No, it's not the territory. Is the social map an accurate portrayal of me, my full potential, is it? No, you can hypnotize people. Someone, let's say, that is a terrible memorizer, and they will remember under hypnotism the name of every person in every class in their grade school. Where they sat, what the rooms look like, what their desk looked like. They can describe their desk in detail. You have to put them on videotape because they won't believe what they just did. It's an inaccurate map. Most people live out of their memory and the social mirror, not out of their imagination and the internal mirror, the true potential, see? And they're constantly limited. The key is to change one's self-map. There's very fundamental resistances against paradigm shifting, particularly if our security lies on things outside ourselves, on our categories, the way we have life figured out, or on our possessions, or on our status symbols, or our credentials, or our reputation. Anything that is extrinsic or external to ourself makes us inwardly insecure, so that it makes us less likely to be open to a whole new concept, see? But if you can cultivate your security deep within yourself, and you're not dependent upon keeping everything outside yourself fixed and frozen and figured out, then you can be very open in your mind and your heart, and you can learn whole new paradigms, new ways of thinking about things, because you're not vulnerable, see? In other words, if down deep you're invulnerable, you can afford to be vulnerable on the surface of your life. But if down deep you're vulnerable, you can't afford to be vulnerable. See, prejudice, prejudgment, is the anatomy of insecurity. See, I have to have prejudgment if inwardly I'm threatened to change my basic foundation of my security, see? So I have to have things figured out and prejudge people or things or ideas. So people that are really open and constantly growing and changing, I maintain, have to constantly nurture the deep internal sources of personal security. It's kind of a fundamental theme that will continually reoccur in this presentation, is the supreme importance of cultivating deep internal sources of personal security. It's one of the greatest keys. You think about the key relationships of your life with your loved ones or with your working associates. You think about them and ask, what paradigm do you have of that person? Is it possible that that is the source of the problem? Sandra and I, with one of our children, were very concerned about a pattern, it seemed to us, that was less than adequate, less than acceptable, academically, socially, athletically, and the social mirror reinforced us. Everyone agreed with us. He'd get up to swing a bat, and his two brothers, you know, would kind of, we'd go up, come on, you guys, knock it off. You had to go through, okay, we just let it alone. God, you can do it, son. Come on, get up there now. We'd psych him up. You can do it. They'd laugh again, you know. We'd get on their backs to get off his back. Try to change our behavior, try to change our attitude. That wasn't the problem. We didn't understand this boy. We didn't see him accurately. We didn't have a good map of the territory. What's the territory? Potential. What's inside, see? We were reacting on the basis of the social mirror, the collective agreement out there about this son. How many of you right now can see potential in your kids far beyond what their teachers see? And it's very upsetting to you that they can't. How many? Look, that's a whole number of us, whole group of us. It's very real. And it's a constant source of upsetness and frustration to parents. Should I tell you what's hurting more? It's not what those teachers are doing. It's the parents' reaction to what those teachers are doing. Well, Sandra and I went through a process, very personal process, of gaining a better understanding of this son. And I'm telling you, the quantum changes that took place, rapid, far beyond the natural maturation processes, were so pronounced and so dramatic, it just shocked other people. But not us. Why would it not shock us? Because the paradigm shifts had taken place in our heads. We saw him differently. We even stopped protecting him from his brother's onslaught, see? Why? Why do you protect someone who's adequate, who's capable, and who is a genius in their own right? Why do you protect him? He even was a product of the social mirror. He wanted us to protect him. We didn't. You don't need to. We can relax. You stop trying to do your thing on your kids. That's the difference between fundamental education and manipulation, where The basic faith is the power is in me to do my thing, to reform you, to clone you according to the right image, see? Instead, you believe deeply in the power inside people, just like in the great constitutional paradigm of this country. Power is in the people to organize and govern themselves, see? Whole different concept, a different paradigm. When that took place, we saw him differently. We saw a report card he brought back. We put it up along with other report cards in our kitchen.
One of the older brothers came up and said, "Whose is that?"
It was straight A plus with one A. "Whose is that?" "It's your brother." "Oh, come on now. Really, who is it?" "No, really, it's your brother." "Oh, come on. Some joke here. Whose is it, really?" "It's your brother." "Is he some kind of a genius?" "Yes, son. He started getting a new concept in his head, see? Social mirror started to change because of the reflection of a new paradigm, a new map." Powerful. The key is to develop a fluid, open mind. It's constantly learning and changing. Build your security on changeless values, things that never change. Changelessness. I'm always intrigued whenever I present back at Armonk at the Executive Development Center for IBM. In fact, I was just there this week, and I saw up there the two pyramids, the management system, the value system. And many times I've seen the top executives, I mean, people like the president or the chairman, come in and say, you know, IBM is many things to many people, products, policies, and so forth. But the one thing that will not change is its belief system. Basically, founded upon the idea of respect for the dignity of the individual, excellence in service. See, then they try to show how that can get translated. And they deal with real problems out there. It's not easy to translate those values into everyday practices in people's lives. But it's always impressive to me to see how you return to changeless things, see? There's a changeless core you can change on the surface. That's the idea.
Now Stephen will outline the maturity continuum, a structure that shows the relationship of each of the seven habits of highly effective people. And he'll tell how you can use it in your life.
I would like to put all seven habits into what I call a maturity continuum. In other words, it shows the relationship they have with each other. I would suggest fundamentally that there are three basic levels to it. The first is dependency, the second, independency, and the third, interdependency. Let me define those three terms briefly. Dependency basically means that you need others to get what you want. Independency means what you think. You can get what you want on your own. You're self-reliant. And interdependency, you get what you want by yourself and with the cooperation of others. Very simple definitions. Now, here is the basic insight, my friends. Until you and I are independent, we cannot be interdependent. We can't do calculus before understanding algebra. We can't run before we can walk. Neither can I learn to work cooperatively with another person if I don't have internal self-mastery. That's why the first three habits deal with self-mastery, self-control, dominion over self. Once a person has control of themselves, when you deal with the next three habits, which help us to become successful with people, successfully interdependent, that person can choose to do so. Short of that, that person cannot. For instance, let's say that this gentleman here is my supervisor, and I am really very dependent upon his opinion of me. Financially, intellectually, emotionally. But let's say he has some blind spots in his performance and he needs feedback. And I'm aware of those blind spots and I have enough skill to give feedback. Would I do it? I wouldn't. I'm too dependent upon him. I'm too angry at him. I'm mad because of those blind spots hurting me. I have what's often called love-hate relationships. You know, the person you're dependent upon also controls you. And if you don't get what you want, it makes you mad, see? So I wouldn't possibly give him feedback. I don't want to rupture my relationship with you. So I talk with you. Talk with you. See, we badmouth him. And you validate me. You're my working associates, and he's our supervisor, see? We're not interdependent. If I were truly interdependent, that means I'm first of all independent. I could go to him and say, could we have a visit? I would like to share some of my concerns. If he were dependent himself on borrowing strength from his position power, he might try to intimidate me. Well, what is it, Stephen? Let's get to it right now. What are your concerns? But if I'm emotionally and intellectually independent of him, I could say to him, we need a little time where we're not interrupted, and let's do it at our mutual convenience. He senses he's dealing with a person of integrity, a power of strength. He also knows from my professional development opportunities, I've got 10 other jobs I could go to at any time. He also knows I'm the only one in his crew that isn't bad-mouthing him. I have no need to bad-mouth. I have no energy around his weaknesses because I want to do something to help him overcome those weaknesses, or perhaps to let me help overcome those weaknesses, see, to compensate for the deficiency. So I'm the most positive person on his team. I'm almost indispensable to him. Now, the first three habits help me develop that kind of strength. The next three help me know how to work effectively with him so that my strength does not intimidate him, so that I can empathize with his head and figure out the best way to make the best presentation, so that the two of us can synergize together and solve the problems. And he sees me as the best source of problem solving in his entire team. That's interdependency. That's where real freedom is. That's where excitement is. That's where the adventure is. The adventure of building a powerful interdependent team. A synergistic culture. Synergy means the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. In a sense, you could say the foundation is character. And this pyramid, personality. If you pull the personality, the techniques of human relations, away from the foundation of character, the person is truncated. They can't handle the stressful situations. They can handle it when the sun is shining. But as soon as you put real pressure, you'll find that all of the internal weaknesses will come out from within. It's like an iceberg. The great mass of the iceberg under the water is the character. The tip of the iceberg, the visible part, is the personality. If the top is separated from the bottom, if I just learn new manipulative techniques of how to get other people to get along, to work better, to be more motivated, but fundamentally I'm filled with duplicity myself and doing a lot of behind-the-scenes kind of manipulations, eventually it'll be found out. In the last analysis, what we are communicates far more eloquently than anything we say, even than anything we do. What we are, it communicates. It builds the emotional bank account, or else it takes huge withdrawals from it. You and I all know this. We know people we trust absolutely because we know their character, whether they're eloquent or not, whether they have the human relations techniques or not. To me, that is the essence of these first three habits, is character. Then, personality. Personality is very important then. Character without the personality won't make it work either. To be highly interdependent, work successfully with teams, that is something else. I look on the first three as a kind of private victory, and the next as the public victory. People that win private victories will win public victories. I know in my life, if I have failed in the public, I know where I can trace it. Somewhere in the privacy of my life. Somewhere I was flaky, irresponsible, reactive, prideful, hypocritical. That's where the problem is. Henry David Thoreau once said, for every 1,000 hacking at the leaves of evil, there is one striking at the root. The root is the character, the foundation of integrity which builds the trustworthiness. Then Everything else builds on top of that and is made effective by it. A habit is an internalized principle, particularly if it's a habit of effectiveness. You've got a natural law we sometimes call a principle that makes sense. For instance, in business, a principle would be to value the customer and to adapt your whole approach in business to the customer. That's a principle. If I've internalized that principle to where I know how to do that, and I want to do it, and I know what to do, that's a habit. So the habit is the overlapping of knowledge, skill, and attitude. Knowledge is what to do. Skill is how to do. Attitude is why to do. Or you could say, want to do. See, I may know how to treat the customer with value to build that relationship. I may know what I should do, but not want to, because I may not feel like I'm treated that way. So it won't be a habit. In another case, I may know what to do to build my relationship with this teenager who's going through this terrific identity crisis and feels alienated from his parents, from the family. I may want to do it, know what to do, but not know how to do it. I don't have the skill. So if I lack the skill, it's not a habit. I might even have certain skill and knowledge, but not want to. A habit is the overlapping of what to do or knowledge, how to do or skill, and why to do, want to do or attitude. Where they overlap, you'll see a habit. Horace Mann, the great educator, once said, habits are like a cable. We weave a strand of it every day, and soon it cannot be broken. I don't personally buy the last expression. I know that they can be broken, because habits can be learned and unlearned, and new habits can be learned. We'll go into that when we discuss habit number one. However, the first part of Horace Mann's statement is so true. People gradually develop a way of thinking, a paradigm, if you will, and also a kind of lifestyle that they are reinforced by in various ways. They have certain kinds of satisfactions, even psychological satisfactions, even though they realize the habit is not a fruitful habit. Nevertheless, it's deep inside them, and it has its play upon their life. So to overcome a habit involves a process and a tremendous commitment. It's almost like the Apollo moon trips put on by NASA many years ago. They had to literally break out of the tremendous gravity pull of the Earth and also the atmosphere surrounding the Earth. And most of the energy that was spent on those fantastic scientific adventures was spent in the first few seconds, even though those moon rockets went over 500,000 miles to the moon and back. But once they were out of the pull of gravity of the Earth, like habits are, gravity, pull us, and out of the atmosphere, the environment that our heads have helped create, they had an amazing level of freedom. In fact, one of the astronauts was interviewed and was asked the question, what was it like for the lunar module and the command module to separate and for the lunar module to go down to the moon? And he answered, through breathing. And the reporter pressed him, what do you mean? He said, it is like the breath of a baby. The amount of freedom that he had, see, because he was not held down by gravity or by atmosphere. But the breaking of the habit, the breaking out of the earth and pulling away from that gravity and that atmosphere requires a level of commitment, a sitting down, a counting of the cost to pay the price. But once it's done, you and I can experience the exhilarating kind of freedom that little NASA metaphor bespeaks.
This is the end of side two.